This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. To understand the presidential race today, you need to go back to 1976. At least that's the case that Ben Bradford makes.
I'm going to tell you the story of a moment after Nixon's fall and a sea change in American politics. It's a moment when new divisive issues emerge to animate our presidential races.
Take a stand against the ERA.
We oppose the widespread practice of abortion on demand.
Bradford is the host and creator of Landslide, a new podcast that looks back at the insurgent campaigns of Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter and how they shaped the political world we know today. The podcast covers the post-Watergate political world amid a fight for the identity of America's political parties. And for all of you political nerds out there, of which I count myself as one, Ben Bradford joins me now to tell this story. Ben, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you're looking back at 1976 and the presidential election then in your podcast. Why this election out of everything you could have looked at?
All right. So I think that the big point that maybe I didn't understand when I first started looking back at our polarization, our partisan gulf, how we got today's politics, is that the political parties may have the same names that they've had for, you know, hundreds of years, but they functionally may as well be different entities than they were just 50 years ago. And if we go back to 1976, we can really see that change happen. So what I mean by that is that the parties, for most of their history, were not divided by ideology as their primary driver. You didn't have a party of the right and a party of the left in the same way. You know, the ideology was mixed and it was muddled, and you had conservative and liberal factions in both. So if you go back to before 1976 and you look at the political parties, you look at the Democrats and the Republicans, and you're asking, well, what's the difference between them? The differences are minuscule compared to today, first of all. And then second of all, Republicans are, you know, they're more business oriented. They tend to have everybody from, you know, wealthier people in cities to farmers in rural areas. And Democrats are the party of labor. They're the party of the New Deal, right? So that tends to be the dividing line. But on defense, they're, you know, relatively similar. This had been a complaint, you know, in 1960 when Richard Nixon is facing John F. Kennedy. The question is experience. It's not that there's a huge difference in their platforms. And on social issues, cultural issues, the parties had actually tried to stay away in many cases, for better and worse, from taking those on. So the way I think about this is, what circle are you drawing around the American electorate, right? And the Republicans and the Democrats are both sort of looking at the middle of the electorate in terms of its ideology, drawing a big circle around it and leaving out the edges. But then you think about what the parties do today and sort of what those circles they're drawing are, and those circles don't reach that far into the other party. So that's what we're watching change in 1976. Part of it is in the Republican Party, where the incumbent president, Gerald Ford, is challenged by this actor who was also considered too fringe and extreme to ever have a chance of getting elected. And that's Ronald Reagan.
Bedtime for Bonzo star.
The star of Bedtime for Bonzo.
Everybody knows that, the chimp movie.
That's absolutely right. And that's in our second episode. You can hear a little bit of Bedtime for Bonzo, because that's sort of the thing that he's tagged with, where Ronald Reagan is starring alongside chimpanzee. And then in the Democratic Party, you can see it really form in many ways into the party that we know today.
Yeah. I'm really struck by, you know, the fact that in the 60s, you have Democrats who are for segregation. You know, you have a George Wallace in the party, and then you also have Democrats who are anti-abortion, for example. I mean, these are things, these cultural issues that people think of as just being not part of the party anymore. As you say, this shift starts to, the seeds for the shift start to be planted here in the late 60s and then into the 70s, and really come to fruition, I think, the beginnings of the change in the 76 election. There's a lot going on in the Republican primary. You can hear how Reagan challenged, you know, a sitting president from his own party, Gerald Ford, for the nomination. It's this wild, contested convention. You got to listen to really understand the whole thing. But today, Ben, we're going to be zeroing in on the story of the Democrats in 1976 as they're vying for their party's presidential nomination. It's a big, wide open field. Spoiler alert, Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter does end up getting the nod. And you argue that Carter served as a mold for future Democratic presidential candidates. Why is that?
Yeah, well, so I don't know what your image of Jimmy Carter is.
Peanut farmer.
Yeah, the smiling peanut farmer, Nobel Peace Prize winner, humanitarian. I think those are probably pretty common images, certainly my image. And one of the things that you hear in this story is how different the people around him, his friends, his campaign strategists, and his enemies, of whom he made many, viewed him. But the other aspect of it is that Carter was pretty conservative. He was conservative in the sense that he didn't want the government to spend a lot of money. So in that sense, he's conservative. And in that sense, is a break from sort of the New Deal Democrats. And in fact, if you talk to Carter's aides and you talk to Gerald Ford's aides, they will tell you that there's not a lot of daylight between them. So, first of all, that creates a more minuscule difference between them on economic issues. And when you get to their general election, which is our upcoming episode, you have less difference between them in general. And the question is, well, how do they differentiate themselves? What does it become about? And there's this sort of new paradigm that Carter creates more broadly. But within the Democratic Party, the idea of somebody who's sort of egalitarian on social issues, but also not the pro-labor guy. This is a huge change, and it sets the mold for Bill Clinton. It sets the mold for, you know, Al Gore and his narrow loss to George W. Bush. It sets the mold actually for Michael Dukakis before him, and you can argue for Barack Obama. So it really becomes the paradigm through which Democrats see themselves as being able to win.
It's a huge shift from, say, a Lyndon Johnson, you know, Great Society.
Absolutely.
You know, creating things like Medicare and Medicaid, of course, the New Deal, you know, the ways that the Democrats became really a dominant force in politics for much of the mid-20th century. You have more of a balance the checkbook style Democrat in Jimmy Carter. And when we tell this story, and you can hear more detail in the podcast Landslide, there is a lot of context that, you know, didn't make it into the show, Ben. And we asked you ahead of this interview if Washington State had a role to play in what was happening during the 70s and the 1976 election. And boy, did you come up with a great Easter egg for Washington State listeners. It turns out you do have a story, right? Tell us more about how Washington plays a role.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're talking about this change that happens in the Democratic Party with Carter's emergence. And throughout this story, you can see other paths that our politics could have taken. And one of them is in the race, one of the big antagonists for Carter, who has his own shot at the Democratic nomination, is the famous, influential mid-century senator from Washington, Henry Scoop Jackson. And when we talk about, you know, what the parties looked like, I think that there is no better emblem of that in many ways than Scoop Jackson, because Jackson wants to spend money. He is coming into this election at a time of economic recession, at a time of spiking unemployment, and he is saying that he wants to pump money into the economy. He wants government to take this assertive role. Contrast that with Carter, who is saying we need to decentralize, we need to deregulate. If there are things that, you know, the people can do that government can do, choose the people. Less government. You know, Scoop Jackson really is sort of the representation of what the Democratic Party had been. And he actually, we don't get into this in our story because Carter that story, there's so many things that he goes through. There's, you know, so many states in the race. But Carter has a hiccup. He has this speed bump that he hits in his sort of rocketing to the nomination. And it's in Massachusetts. So Carter wins the Iowa caucus. He wins the New Hampshire primary. But the next primary he really needs to win is Florida. The person he's going to face in Florida is the person that you mentioned earlier, the racist Alabama governor, George Wallace, who is this other person who at the time, and this is mind-blowing, seems like he could be the Democratic nominee. But before that, Scoop Jackson beats Carter pretty handily in Massachusetts, big state. And all of a sudden, Carter's momentum slows, and there seems to be this pathway for him. And then Jackson wins in New York, another big state. And finally, as Carter has kept winning elsewhere, Jackson and Carter face off in Pennsylvania. And the old line Democratic Party labor movement, you know, this is the trade unions, the AFL-CIO, these places that had been, you know, big money, big voter turnout. They all sort of get behind Jackson because they're worried about Carter and what it's going to mean for the party if he wins. And so they have their kind of big showdown there. And when Carter wins that race against Jackson, you know, it is really a turning point in many ways, I would say, for the party, because, you know, even if Jackson doesn't win the nomination, a lot of the candidates at the time are just trying to stop Carter. If they can stop him from getting a majority of delegates, then it'll go to the convention, which is what happened with Reagan and Ford on the Republican side. If that happens, there's a real chance that Jimmy Carter, you know, maybe he's selected for vice president, but that he is not the candidate of the Democratic Party. He does not become the paradigm for the Democratic Party.
There's something kind of perfect about this, you know, decentralization candidate, somebody who is not into big government spending at the federal level, being a governor of a southern state. And then
absolutely
his counterpoint, right, being a senator, kind of an old patrician style, you know, emblem of like federal authority. And
decades in Washington.
Yeah. Scoop Jackson and Carter, both Democrats, of course. We've heard kind of a little bit about where their primary race, you know, how that path unfolded. What about their politics itself? I mean, there's a lot of space between Jimmy Carter and Scoop Jackson on a number of positions. I want to play a quick clip.
And my program as President of the United States can be summed up in one word, job.
Jackson's promise here is a sort of modernized New Deal, stressing jobs through public works projects. It has certain appeal in Massachusetts, where unemployment is almost 11.5%.
Okay, so translate that for us, Ben. How did Scoop Jackson's politics, how can they be understood there in what we're hearing, like a new deal? And also, why was that catching on in Massachusetts?
Yeah, oh, I think you heard, first of all, that the country is dealing with two different things that people to that point hadn't thought could happen at the same time. One is inflation, and the other is recession. So unemployment is spiking at the same time as the value of the dollar is going down. And, you know, we see today sort of the Fed fighting inflation. And this is ultimately tools that we see develop when Carter himself is president and decides that austerity is the path and that, you know, raising interest rates is the way to deal with stagflation. But before that, people didn't know. So what Scoop Jackson wants to do is not only a jobs program, not only does he want to spend money, he wants to implement wage and price controls, which is the government capping how much businesses can raise people's salaries and how much they can charge for goods. And you think about that level of government intervention, that had been done before. Nixon had done it several times, and often for political gain and often creating further inflation later. But Jackson wants to do that. And this is considered sort of a tool that the government has that is a reasonable tool, whether people want to do it or not, right? It's an option in the arsenal. And then on the other side of it, Jackson had been a big proponent of civil rights in the 1960s. He had voted for the Civil Rights Act. He'd voted for the Voting Rights Act. He was considered very, very strong on it. But as the 1960s turned to the 1970s, and you have the counterculture, the anti-war protesters, you know, students protesting, the hippies, Jackson is much more culturally conservative. And he is a big proponent of the Vietnam War. He is a hawk on the Vietnam War. And so he doesn't like any of that. And actually, there's a little side story going back to 1972, where George McGovern has sort of, the liberal Democratic candidate, has created this coalition of anti-Vietnam War protesters and women's rights groups and women's rights supporters. And, you know, the gay rights movement is getting behind him. And Jackson is one of the people who helps tag McGovern as the candidate of acid, amnesty, and abortion, which is part of what helps sink him.
Oh, that's quite a combination.
It is quite a combination. But it also says something about Jackson and who he was, which is, again, liberal on spending, but also when it comes to sort of rights and culture, he's culturally conservative. And that paradigm essentially does not exist in American politics anymore.
We're going to walk through just really quickly the end of that Democratic primary process here. We're up to, in 1976, the showdown in Pennsylvania, Jackson's final stand against Carter, and he loses.
It is generally conceded today that the Pennsylvania returns, along with Carter's other primary victories, guarantee him a place on the Democratic ticket this year. Here's how it came out in Pennsylvania. Carter won 37% of the vote.
And really quick, Ben, why was Pennsylvania so important?
Yeah, I mean, Pennsylvania is a state with a lot of delegates, and it is also, the goal at this point is to stop Carter from getting the majority of delegates. And if Jackson wins, you know, when you have a high profile win as a candidate, the money comes in. And so it really becomes Jackson's last stand. And it also in some ways becomes, you know, the labor movement and sort of the old line Democratic Party's last stand against Carter. And I think you hear that in that clip.
Carter, the outsider in so many ways, is the one who emerges victorious from this new style of primaries that emphasizes the states. You know, he famously surprises everybody in the Iowa caucuses. It's the new brand of campaigning that we hadn't seen before for a presidential nomination. And he defeats this ultimate insider, Scoop Jackson. Here's a clip of Carter talking about Jackson.
I think Senator Jackson is one of the finest men I've ever met. He's a very good public servant. I think he's been in the Congress 35 years. And I look forward to working very closely with him when I'm president and he's still in the Senate.
Oof, so kind of a burn there from Carter and really leaning into the insider-outsider dynamic. I mean, Ben, this is still a really popular way to run, right? Folks claiming that outsider status. Why do you think it's so successful still today?
Okay, so that is an absolutely great point. And it's a thing that we explore in our next episode when we look at the general election. Because again, it is exactly that paradigm that you described, the consummate insider in Gerald Ford, who had been in Congress for, you know, 30 years versus Carter, who has been the governor of Georgia for 4 years. He's out of office. He'd been a state senator a little bit before that. And he's not emphasizing any of that. He's emphasizing the farmer. So when Carter wins, it is another paradigm change, which is exactly what you described, which is the rise of the outsider. And there is this thing that I just think is amazing, which, because you can apply that paradigm to almost any race going forward. And you think about who has been president since Carter. Every single president has either run as an outsider or been the vice president to someone who's run as the outsider. And I think that there's a lot of reasons for it. We explore them in the series. Part of it is just distrust. After Watergate, after Vietnam, you watch trust in government collapse in a way we've never recovered from. And that creates the conditions that allow someone like Carter and allow someone like Reagan. But the outsider is absolutely a paradigm that stays with us. And the question that I have is, you know, what happens if we are constantly electing people who tell us how much our government is not working and we sort of never move away from that?
Yeah. Biden being the, you know, one exception that you mentioned there that was a vice president to somebody.
And George H.W. Bush.
And George H.W. Bush, yeah, who was Reagan's vice president. You know, these are folks who were part of the machine, but they were able to kind of ride the coattails of people saying that they were outsiders. You know, you're painting this picture, Ben, in Landslide of a battle over the identity of the Democratic Party, a battle over the identity of the Republican Party that really shapes politics still today. Today, parties are realigning around certain issues that you never thought you would see in 1976. The Republican Party, for example, really removing its support for, fighting wars against what used to be the Soviet Union, against Russia, like the, you know, not wanting to fund what's happening in Ukraine. Former President Trump suggesting that he would encourage Russia to attack NATO allies if they didn't supposedly, you know, pay their fair share. When you look back at these intra-party fights from the 1970s, what do they teach us about what's happening today in this realignment?
I think it tells us a lot about why it's happening today. So you mentioned this new wave of Republicans, and you mentioned, you know, the just reversal of GOP orthodoxy on so many issues.
Can you imagine what Ronald Reagan would say to that comment from President
It is very
Trump.
Hard to conceive. Yeah. However, if we think about what the coalition is, and this is something that we really explore in the series that you hear happen, and you hear it through the archival footage of the time and from the people who were there, and it's really a historical fact. The coalition that gets put together by Reagan is a coalition that is focused more than anything on backlash to a changing culture, backlash to civil rights, the women's rights movement, to the changes of the time. And his stances on defense and on foreign policy and all those kind of things play into that. And there's no question that Reagan's sort of driving force was a fervent anti-communism. But if you look at who is voting for him, why are they voting for him? I always think about what's the difference between Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan? They're both very staunchly don't want to spend a lot of money. Later on, there are defense issues that sort of emerge and Reagan kind of strikes on them. But more than any of it, there is a nationalism, there is a backlash to the changing culture, and you look at who's voting for who. Ford is getting votes in the Northeast and the Midwest, these traditional Republican territories. And Ronald Reagan is winning the South. And he is winning the South by getting Republicans. And then in these other states where the primaries are new and Democrats can cross over and vote in the Republican primaries, he starts having these big victories by reaching out to the supporters of George Wallace, that Alabama governor who'd stood in the schoolhouse door to prevent integration, who had always run campaigns based on racial grievance and getting white voters. And if you look at the coalitions that are, you know, it's called the New Right, these grassroots groups that are fundraising for Reagan and organizing for Reagan and really power him to victory, that's the coalition. And I think if you look today at this new wave of Republicans who are increasingly being called the new right, that thread is still there. You can see that through line through it. And of course, you can do something similar on the Democratic side, where you look at sort of this push-pull between the focus on social issues and the focus on economic issues and this sort of fight within the party. And you can see a lot of what I think we see today develop.
Ben Bradford is the creator and host of Landslide, which is a co-production of Nuanced Tales, WFAE in Charlotte, and NPR. And we'll post a link to the show on our website. I really encourage everybody, if you love political history, Ben is a wonderful storyteller, and he has delved into the archives to get some amazing tape. It's just a great way that you've woven all this together, Ben, and really taught us, taught me a lot about what's going on today. I really recommend the show. And thank you so much for being here, Ben.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.